Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to Cable News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Sandra Tutel from the Cascade Life Alliance, here to talk about organ donation and the work that this organization does. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here today.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. So let's get into it. What is Cascade Life Alliance for people who don't know?
I am the manager of the community outreach program, which is new for Cascade Life Alliance, and two outreach coordinators that have been working with me to develop this program. We are going out to the communities. We've been to like Juneteenth, Oregon, the Delta Park powwow, the Blues Fest. We just go into a lot of community events in order to do organ, tissue, and eye donation education. We're also, as a result of a state law that goes into effect academic year 2025, are preparing a new, very engaging, inspiring high school curriculum. So there was a 16-year-old girl, her name was Nisha, and she met with Representative Rayfield out of Corvallis, yes, and she just gave him a presentation and talked about the need for organ, eye, and tissue donation to be provided to high school students before they actually go to the driver's or to the DMV to get their driver's license when they're asked that question, you know, do you want to be an organ donor? And so he was so impressed with what she presented, and he worked with some others, and they created House Bill 3234, which states that in academic year 2025, that organ, eye, and tissue donation will be required at all Oregon high schools, usually in a health class, which would occur their first or second year of school. And so this would be before they go to the DMV. So out of that, we wanted to just really make sure that they had the proper information, that they had all the resources they need. And when I say they, I mean the teachers that are now tasked with providing this education. And then also, if they wanted someone to come into their school to do the presentation themselves, you know, that was an option. So we're currently working on putting this, you know, we're trying to build a curriculum, like I said, that is engaging, inspiring, but also like relevant to a high school student, and hopefully so they can see themselves in this situation, either having to make a decision themselves, or, you know, if they ever, you know, God forbid, do need a transplant. So we're putting this curriculum together. This will be available. We'll offer it this year.
Okay.
And just kind of, you know, find any things that need to be changed, any tweaks to the program. And if they can go online, they can fill out a form that will either request an in-person or a virtual presenter. Yes, the teachers can.
Nice.
And then, or give them all of the curriculum and all of the tools and resources they need themselves to teach it themselves. So they'll have these options, and then answer any questions. And so right now we're in the process of putting postcards together that will get sent out to all the high schools to give them this information and where they need to go. And we're also, you know, doing emails, and then even, you know, some schools that we're going to try to make sure we get into, you know, in our first year. So we'll be doing some phone calls. So we're really busy right now putting this all together and hopefully providing just something that really speaks to these students and that they'll, you know, that they'll take away and go home and talk to their families about it. And because a lot of times, you know, they don't, you know, what you might learn in school, you're not bringing home, but this is a conversation for the entire family, not just for the student themselves.
I wanted to ask about that point, though, talking about it having relevancy to high school students. What is some of the thinking about what specifically makes it relevant to high school students and thinking about that in the curriculum?
Right. Well, most people that are registered donors are registered through the DMV. So that is where the majority of people will be asked that question and take that opportunity to become a registered donor. So we want to make sure that you have all the information beforehand and answer any, you know, if there's any misconceptions or confusion, and just make sure they really understand what they're being asked. And our job is not to push them, you know, pressure them into signing up, but just making sure they have all the information they need to make an informed choice on that.
Yeah.
And so the reason for high school is because of really the age of getting your driver's license and going in. But you can register in a variety of ways. You can register on your iPhone health app. There's registerme.org. But most people do register through the DMV.
Yeah. Is there, when thinking about organ donation and matching folks up with a potential donor, is age a factor in that?
No, there's a lot of criteria in matching the organ donor to the recipient, but age is not. So we just had a 98-year-old man that donated his liver and was placed into a 72-year-old woman who was doing quite well. So a lot of times people feel like they're too old or, you know, they've had a hard life and that nobody would want, you know, their organs. But the reality is anyone can register to be a donor. And you would be really surprised who actually, you know, can qualify to donate their organs. And if it's not organs, it's corneas and tissue. This enhances the lives of hundreds of people. You know, an organ donor can save the lives up to 8 people, but you can also, improve the health of hundreds of people through tissue and cornea donation. So a person should just, you know, realize that regardless of their age or health conditions, that there is a likelihood that they can, leave the legacy of a donation, be it organ or tissue.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the statistics? Like, how many people are signed up for this kind of thing in Oregon?
Yeah. So in the state of Oregon, we have over 3 million registered donors, which seems like a huge amount, right? So in the country, there are over 100,000 people on the transplant waiting list. So it seems like with those kind of numbers, this shouldn't be a problem. But it is actually very difficult to be an organ donor. It's an incredibly complex process. Mm-hmm. And so the likelihood of being an organ donor is pretty low. So that's why you need to have such huge numbers of people registered to be donors. Right now, with the waiting list, about 60% of the transplant waiting list are people from communities of color, and about 30% of registered donors are from the same communities of color. And this is really important to address this because the matching of an organ donor with a recipient is much improved when they are from the same race. And so when you have better matching, you have better outcomes. And you have, you know, better transplant outcomes, and you have longer lasting grafts, which of course is very important. And so we're just really trying. August is the National Multi-Ethnic Donor Awareness Month, and it's a really great opportunity to talk about these numbers and actually why these numbers exist. You know, people from communities of color often have higher numbers of health conditions such as diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. And these conditions did not come out of nowhere. There's reasons for these health conditions, and it can be years of discrimination, inadequate access, and discriminatory healthcare policies. And so we want to have those honest conversations and talk about that and talk about why that need is so large and also address that need. And that's by increasing the number of registered donors is going to increase the likelihood of receiving a transplant from somebody of the same race, and which has proven to have better outcomes.
Yeah. So is that work that Cascade Life Alliance is doing in Oregon to try to get more Oregonians of color to consider becoming an organ donor?
Absolutely. That's why we're out at these community events. We are volunteering with organizations. We are happy to speak at any events or organizational meetings that if anybody has interest in this, the curriculum that we're putting together in high schools addresses this. Mm. We're just trying to provide a lot of resources and information and just have those difficult but, you know, real conversations about this. I mean, my family is Native American. My mom was born and raised on a reservation and didn't have the best relationships or best experiences with healthcare providers on the reservation. And so when I was a child, she told me not to be an organ donor. She told me that they would let me die on the table and give my organs to white people. And that was, you know, that's what I was heard as a child. And I believe that. Now, obviously, a lot of years have gone by. I know that to not be true. My mom knows that not to be true. We are both registered donors. And oddly enough, here I am working in donation education. So, but she had good reason to have those feelings and those views. And but with the learning, you know, more about it and understanding that, you know, your healthcare team, you're brought into an emergency room, a life-changing event, and that entire team is going to do everything they can to save your lives. They are completely unaware of your organ donation status. It's, you know, there's no thought of organ donation until every measure has been taken to save that patient's life before it's, and a referral is even made to Cascade Life Alliance. So these are two different teams. And, you know, there's just every measure will always be taken to save a patient's lives before organ donation would ever be considered. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back with, you know, to my mom, having this information and just learning more has changed, you know, how she sees it and obviously how I look at organ donation.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question. As you're doing this work out in the community, are there misconceptions that you encounter?
Well, that's one of them. People, mm-hmm. you know, I hear a lot. It's been really fun to do these community outreach events because people love to share, you know, what their concerns are or, you know, just stories they've heard. And it's been a lot of fun to hear the different things. But it's also very serious because it stops a lot of people from being a registered donor. So one of them is, you know, their concern that the doctor won't try to save their lives. And the other one, our other ones include that I'm too old. I've had this illness. I've had cancer. I had, you know, this, you know, health event that they feel would eliminate their chances of being an organ donor. And we just always say register. Just register. Because, like I said, there's also cornea and tissue that enhances the lives of hundreds of others. But, you know, our medical professionals will know. They know your medical history. They're going to go over, you know, your records. They're going to do tests. I mean, you just might really be surprised on who ends up being an organ donor. So if you have an opportunity to give this amazing gift of life and have that legacy and you know, saving lives, like, you take that opportunity. And also, we have a lot of families that report that knowing that their loved one was a donor and is leaving that legacy really, you know, brought them some comfort during the most horrible time of their life. And it helped with that healing. And a lot of families are volunteers because of that interaction with other people that receive transplants, knowing that their loved one was part of that is really, you know, really quite amazing for them. And so there's just a lot of good reasons, you know, to do this. And if there's concerns, you know, there's always, you know, places to get that information and to ask those questions and, you know, mm-hmm. address those concerns. But yeah, there's, I'm trying to think off the top of my head some of the other misconceptions of, like, usually it's around age or people are, you know, some people are concerned about religious beliefs, and most major, all major religions support organ donation and see it as an act of generosity and love, you know, end of life. Some people are concerned about open casket funerals, which are completely possible with organ, eye, and tissue donation. It doesn't affect that. I mean, there's a lot. But if you go to our website, which is CascadeLifeAlliance.org, you know, we address all of those and, you know, give the answers and give links to other resources that if you want to research that further.
Mm-hmm. So to circle back, can you tell me a little bit about the process of how organ and tissue donation works?
Yes. So at Cascade Life Alliance, we are one of 56 federally designated organ procurement organizations in the country. And we service, our designated service area includes the state of Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Southwest Idaho. Mm-hmm. And we are the organization that receives referrals when somebody is a potential organ donor after all measures have been taken to save that person's life. And we then go out to the hospitals, we, you know, review charts, review records, and see, you know, determine the potential of that person being an organ donor. If it is determined that they are eligible, we then have staff that are trained in providing support to families and giving them the information about organ donation as an option, mm-hmm. answering their questions, and just, you know, really doing what they need to do to support that family. If the family authorizes donation or if the person is a registered donor, the organ procurement, or that's when they look at the national waiting list, the database, and start to find these matches. And like I said before, matches are based on a lot of criteria, so it's not a real simple, you know, thing to do. But so while they're looking at the database, doing tasks, you know, finding the best match, the transplant team is preparing to procure organs once those matches are found. So then transplant surgeons will come to the OR. They will procure the organs. They will oftentimes then do cornea and tissue. And then our perfusion team comes in and takes care of the very time-sensitive transporting of these organs to the transplant centers where the identified recipients are living at. So organs stay within the state of Oregon or a designated service area, but they also go to other places based upon who is a match, and also location and time. And there's just, you know, it's a very complex process. So that's what Cascade Life Alliance does. And we also now are really focused on providing that education to the community and to the high schools.
Mm-hmm. If listeners are interested in finding out more information, what do you recommend?
So if you want to register to be a donor, if you want to get right to that, you can go to registerme.org. You can go to your DMV, have that added to your driver's license. You can go to our website, which is cascadelifealliance.org. And on every page, there's a button to be a registered donor. If you want to learn more about the high school curriculum that we're developing or the community outreach events that we're attending, if you want to request a speaker, you go to cascadelifealliance.org/outreach, and all of our contact information is on there.
Very cool. Well, Sandra, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
I appreciate the time very much.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Patches. Project 2025 has gotten increasing mainstream media coverage in the past few months, even as the Trump campaign has tried to distance themselves from it. It's a 920-page blueprint for the next Republican president. Project 2025 was written by the Heritage Foundation and other right-wing organizations. Ann Nelson teaches at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the nature and significance of Project 2025.
Is what the right is doing with Project 2025 kind of a continuation of what started with Reagan, you know, this idea of rolling back all the gains that were made in the 60s and even before, or is it something really totally new?
Well, as I stated in my Washington Spectator piece, it is the newest iteration of a project that's been going on for over 40 years, where these same organizations have had similar goals over this period, although they've expanded them. But at their core are the religious rights, what you might call culture war issues, which is rolling back reproductive rights for women, rolling back voting rights for minorities, rolling back civil and political rights for LGBTQ people. So those have remained constant, and they overlap with the interests of the major donors, many of them from the fossil fuel industry, who don't want any environmental regulations and would rather not pay any taxes. So you combine those with measures to really restrict funding for public schools, public health, public environmental initiatives that are all paid for with tax money. So once you limit those, you basically concentrate more power and more money in the hands of the top 1% and less in the bottom 50%.
And you would say these kind of policies are already being implemented on the state level?
Oh, yes. There are various states that have been laboratories. But really, as you say, it goes back to the Reagan era. And at that time, you had measures that the administration carried out to limit the influence of labor unions. And that was a major issue in that period. And the labor unions in the United States have never recovered. In the 1970s, you had the greatest income equality of our lifetimes. That has been reversed. And now we have the greatest income inequality we've had for over 80 years. So the tax regimes that have been imposed under Republican administrations have made it possible for many billionaires to get away without paying any taxes at all, whereas a disproportionate tax burden falls, you know, on people who make a minimum income. So it's been progressive. What is new about Project 2025 is that, you know, if you look back over 40 years, you have a Republican administration that takes these measures, a Democratic administration that will whittle away at them and maybe take a step backward into the more egalitarian era. Then the Republicans come back. Project 2025 tries to build on the authoritarian qualities of the Trump administration in the first round, concentrate more power in the presidency, and remove power from the federal agencies, and make the courts and the FBI more responsible for the White House, and take various steps to consolidate power in the presidency and to limit the possibilities of displacing the administration in future elections.
I mean, there's already a problem with the regulatory agencies, right? I mean, there's this constant revolving door, the people in the industries they're supposed to be regulating sometimes serve on these agencies, and you're saying that this could get much worse. You're saying that
What Project 2025 calls for is to abolish the Department of Education and various other federal agencies, and to abolish various departments in federal agencies that are responsible for the scientific accumulation of data about the environment and pollution and about food safety, right? They want to abolish these services to the public altogether. So yes, the revolving door and some corrupt appointments are certainly a problem, but this is just sweeping the protective apparatus off the table.
So Trump has his own agenda. Is that any different than Project 2025?
The way to understand it is that there are over 100 organizations that have signed on in support of Project 2025. And very roughly, half of them are funded by the Koch Network. Roughly, very roughly, half of them funded by Leonard Leo's Catholic Extremist Marble Trust. And then there's an overlap between those two. And so it is impossible. It is impossible to imagine any Republican candidate being elected without the support of these 100 organizations. They are the ones that are driving the donor base, they're driving the canvassing, they're driving the strategy, as they did with Trump in 2016, but to a lesser degree than they would do now. They have more money and more capability now than they did. So you saw Nikki Haley trying to launch a candidacy that made a few gestures that were independent of some of these positions and failing like other would-be candidates. These are the people who are controlling the party. And it's important to note that in Project 2025, they state whether it's President Trump returning to office, whether it's another conservative or GOP candidate, this is the game plan. This is essentially the party platform.
Are the Democrats already pushing back against this, or as you say, are they just trying to whittle away a little bit and not really take it seriously enough?
There have been various statements about it, including coming out of the Biden campaign, where they're trying to highlight the dangers that lie in its pages. I don't think there's a full-fledged campaign that stresses it at this point, and even though it's been released for several months now, it's over 900 pages long. It's very dense. It has many, many actions that would be very damaging that could be achieved by executive order early in the administration. It has other measures that probably couldn't be achieved that simply aren't realistic or don't even make sense. So, for example, one of the lines in the text says, every child has the right to be raised by its biological father and mother. And it may be a failure of my imagination, but I can't imagine them coming in and abolishing the practice of adoption and foster care and all the other subsidiary ways that parenting actually occurs, right? That doesn't seem realistic to me, although I can see that what they were trying to word it as is an anti-marriage equality LGBTQ parental phrase, but the way it's worded is impossible to implement. So you can't read it as something that could be executed in every aspect of the text, but you do have to look at it as a very serious declaration of intent with much that could be executed.
How much attention has the project gotten in the mainstream media?
There have been a lot of references, but it's been very difficult to cover, partly because of its length and also because of the dense bureaucratic language. You know, I did read the whole thing.
Must have been exhausted.
It gives you a headache. But in my piece for the Washington Spectator, I pulled out 10 aspects that I thought the public needed to review. And there are other groups that are pulling out items and signaling them as causes for alarm, because as I say, this is a serious declaration of intent. And there's certainly a strong possibility you could have a Republican administration elected in November. So people need to know what exactly they're voting for. And I think that there are items in this document that would shock people and others that the majority of Americans would not agree with. They want no emissions controls. They even want to abolish energy ratings on your air conditioner, right? Because it is so much at the service of the fossil fuels industry that they want to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord and all other environmental international agreements. They just want to basically abolish climate science and climate policy. And as we know from the Trump administration, you could advance that through a combination of legislation and judicial rulings and administrative action. You could set climate science and climate policy back years by the combination of powers that they would have. And the planet and our country cannot afford this. I don't need to tell people in California, much less other parts of the country that are experiencing environmental crises, that this is exactly the wrong time to reverse climate policy.
Do you think there's anything in the project, in the program, that would turn off Republican voters if they knew about it?
I would have to think more about exactly how they would think about it. For example, there are Republican voters who have adopted children, too. How would they consider this statement?
There's even evangelicals who care about the environment.
There are those. And I think that there are a lot of very middle-of-the-road Americans who would be just as happy to know what the energy rating on their air conditioner is and spend a little bit less on their electric bill, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just common sense. And it astonishes me that the fossil fuels company haven't quite caught up with the rest of the country and think that they have to squeeze every last penny out of environmental degradation rather than just going with the flow and investing in clean energy. But, you know, I think that there are Republican voters that have a Prius too. You know, there are all kinds of things in this that they should object to. But the problem is that so many of the Republican voters have their attention focused on single issues by the media that dominate their environment. And quite often, those issues are presented to them in a fallacious way. So if you're focused on, say, abortion, what they're being told is literally that Democrats support abortion up to the day of birth of a healthy baby, which is false. It is absolutely false. But if you believe that and you're told that that's the one issue you should be voting on, then the rest of the threats that affect your actual lives don't really penetrate. But among the nuances in these documents are just rolling back rights on such a vast level that is almost hard to comprehend. So So, for example, the introduction of this document wants to ban terms from all federal language, legislation, regulations, bills. And those terms include the word gender, the term reproductive health. Now, I have to assume that Republican women would value their reproductive health. I would assume any woman would. And how on earth do you serve it if you banish the very vocabulary? So the problem is that you have to go into the document, as I did, and pull out these passages to see what they're actually talking about. And my piece, I feel, is a contribution, but it scratches the surface. There's 900 pages in there to delve into. And what we need is a small army of people with specialized knowledge in environmental issues, and agriculture, and reproductive health, in the care of children, in public health, to go in and dissect this document and educate the public about what's being threatened. Another passage that bothered me a great deal was that it said that officials from the CDC should not be allowed to advise vaccinations for school children. So we already have a measles outbreak in 17 states in this country. You have a death rate among children of 1 to 2 per 1,000 in cases of measles, which could be very serious. They think that children and their parents should not be advised to be vaccinated against deadly diseases. I would assume that Republican parents love their children too. So it's a quite a sweeping document and one that has very, very serious implications.
That was Ann Nelson, author, lecturer, and consultant on international media issues. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about Project 2025. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Patches. Thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1990,